Good morning, everyone. This is the NBC Newsroom in New York, about to bring you reports from Berlin, London, and Washington. On this, the 589th day of war, we hear first from the Reich. Go ahead, Berlin.
Hello, NBC. This is Theodor Knaut speaking from Berlin. The communique of the German High Command just out announces that the mass of the Yugoslav army has been destroyed. The remnants are retiring into the mountains along the Adriatic coastline and are showing only isolated resistance. In northern Greece, operations are proceeding according to plan. In Africa, the Germans have occupied Souloum across the frontier of Egypt. A German submarine has sunk a British 10,000-ton auxiliary cruiser off Iceland. The British made no flights into German territory last night. Japan's Matsuoka left Moscow last evening, and Stalin, Molotov, the German and Italian ambassadors, and representatives of all the three power-packed states were on hand to see him off. In addition to the pact of non-aggression and friendship between Japan and Soviet Russia, the two governments also signed an agreement guaranteeing the integrity of Japanese-controlled Manchukuo and of the Russian-controlled People's Republic of Mongolia. That is the news the German radio has just brought on this Easter Monday holiday, when all the other sources of information are closed. It is the fourth holiday in a row for many people, as offices and some stores were closed on Saturday. Under normal circumstances, most of Berlin would be out in the fresh air today, but travel by rail has been discouraged, and so the excursions that are being made nevertheless have to be at not too far a distance from the city. As it is, most people seem to be content with staying at home, and the streets are pretty empty. It is always strange to see these wide boulevards with hardly a single automobile in sight. Owing to the holiday, no newspapers were published today, and the only source of news is the radio bulletins, which have not had much to say either in the way of new developments. Officials are mostly out of town and comment on the Treaty of Friendship and Non-Aggression that was announced yesterday as having been signed between Russia and Japan, is therefore almost unobtainable at the moment. From what I hear, the new treaty has met with a favorable response here, and it does not come as a surprise. The extended stay which Foreign Minister Matsuoka made in Moscow, and the repeated conferences he had with Foreign Commissar Molotov and with Stalin too, had led everyone to believe that something was in the wind, and that there would be a concrete result from his visit to the Soviet capital. The pact is regarded here as a positive instrument and not merely as negative in its provisions. Its most important feature is, of course, the fact that if either country is attacked by a third power, the other will remain neutral. In this connection, it must not be forgotten that German officials have repeatedly emphasized that the deliveries they are receiving from Russia under the trade agreement are highly satisfactory and are in excess of the amounts stipulated. There has been little military news of importance given out here today, but we learn that a further 33,000 tons of enemy shipping was sunk on Saturday in addition to what was reported yesterday. Three ships for a total of 28,000 tons were sunk out of a convoy that was attacked in St. George's Channel, and two more, a 10,000-tonner and a smaller vessel, were seriously damaged, it is claimed. That Malta was once more bombed and the airports of La Venezia and Lucca hit, with British planes destroyed on the ground, is also a further bit of news, as is the fact that two balloons were downed over the English Channel at Dover. In Yugoslavia, the recent news has been more in regard to the cleaning up of territory occupied or threatened than in the way of fresh advances. The capture of Belgrade, reported yesterday, is in this category, and so are the advances of the Italians into Slovenia, and even the occupation by the Hungarians of territory that was taken from them after the last war. In Africa, the Germans have crossed the Egyptian frontier, where the Italians were last fall before the British drove them back. How far will the advance continue now? And will it threaten Cairo? That is the point to watch. Yesterday's Frankfurter Zeitung brought a conservatively written account of the revolt in Yugoslavia that precipitated the German advance there, and asks the question, did this have to be? It was a typical military coup d'etat, says the Frankfurter's correspondents, and he makes the interesting disclosure that the Yugoslav people had not been informed by their former government of what was in the wind. They thought that a two-way pact of friendship was to be signed, like the others that had been signed with neighboring countries, and knew nothing of the concessions that had been made to Yugoslavia, one of which was that she was to have Saloniki and access to the Aegean Sea. This is Theodore Knaut speaking from Berlin and returning you to NBC.
Back in New York, just long enough for our engineers to rearrange circuits so that you may hear from our reporter in England. All right, go ahead, London.
This is John McVane in London. Official Norwegian circles in London today confirmed reports from Stockholm that a naval raid was made on the North Norwegian coast yesterday. The raid was made by a Norwegian warship, acting in agreement with the British Navy. Results are said to have been successful, and a statement will probably be issued on the raid when full reports are made. As Yugoslav resistance to the German mechanized units stiffened in the mountain valleys, it was reliably reported in London today that Yugoslav forces have occupied Durazzo in Albania. The drive on Durazzo seems to have been made by the Yugoslav units who took Scutari and crossed the Drim River. The occupation of Durazzo cuts one of the chief lines of retreat for the Italian army in Albania. If the drive continues, it will take the Italians, now facing the main Greek army, in the rear. The only hope for the Italians seems to be the possibility that the Germans can send enough tanks and men into Albania to join up with the Italians and snatch them from disaster. According to authoritative information in London, the morale of the Yugoslavian forces is excellent, and they are counterattacking north of Niš. The battle at Kragujevac is swaying back and forth. The Germans took the town, then the Yugoslavs retook it, and now the Germans have taken it for the second time. Information has just reached London that on Good Friday, an Adolf Hitler SS division attacked British infantry units in northern Greece. The German division was repulsed with heavy losses. At the moment, according to dispatches from Greece, fighting between the British and Germans is confined to clashes between patrols. The Germans are said to have paid heavily for their successes so far. One Athens report seems to indicate that the British intend to make a finished fight of it in Greece and Yugoslavia. The report says that more and more British Imperial troops are arriving continuously. Dispatches reaching London from Cairo say that in the eastern sector in Greece, British forces counterattacked with a bayonet charge to drive back advancing German forces. The Athens radio said the British showed superiority over the German troops, and it was apparent that the Germans were afraid of the British. Possibly the British did carry out a successful bayonet charge. But if they did, it was one of those flukes that prove the rule. The rule that modern wars aren't won at the point of the bayonet. When you see pictures of troops training with a bayonet, they may look very martial and grim, but the actual military value of the weapon is slight. Two or three men with Tommy guns can make a shambles of a bayonet charge by 50 men. Two men with a heavy machine gun can calmly cut to pieces a bayonet charge at 500 yards. Bayonets are no use against tanks, and even in the sort of skirmishing where you'd think they would be most valuable, bayonets have proved useless. In the Indian fighting out in front of the Maginot Line in the first winter of the war, the French daredevil corps men, armed with rifles, bayonets, and pistols, took a beating from the better-armed Germans until at last they were equipped with submachine guns. If half a dozen enemy soldiers suddenly rush at you from behind cover, your bayonet will be of little use. But if you have a submachine gun, you have more than a fighting chance. At least that's what experience so far has proved. This is a war of equipment. Unless you can equip your soldier better than the man he is to meet, you'd better keep him at home and not send him into the fighting line at all. There is no late news from the Libya and Egypt operations in London. Dispatches from Egypt say the situation is viewed with confidence and that the British defending units have been strengthened considerably since the German attack began. Commentators in London take the course of events in Libya as a warning to Britain not to become complacent about the possibility of a successful German invasion of this island. The Evening Standard points out that a channel 80 miles wide divided Libya from Nazi-held territories. But the Standard declares that that fact didn't stop the Germans from throwing their tanks and troops across the gap. The British sank more than 100,000 tons of Nazi shipping in the Straits of Sicily, but enough tanks got across to penetrate the British defenses. Speculating on a possible German attempt to land two mechanized divisions of 800 tanks in Britain, the Standard warns that Hitler has 5,000 or 6,000 tanks to risk. Landings would be attempted at 100 points by troops coming from Norway, Denmark, and France. The Standard draws the moral that now is the time for the British to stretch every resource to build tanks, anti-tank guns, armor-piercing shells, and dive bombers. A few bombs at points along the coast and some casualties in a town in the northwest of England formed the only air activity over Britain during the night. British planes last night attacked Merignac Aerodrome and the docks at Bordeaux. This is John McVane in London, returning you to the National Broadcasting Company in New York.
Now the news at home, reported by Earl Godwin from our newsroom in Washington.
Good morning, and spring turns into summer. They promise us almost 90 degrees today, and Washington's first business is the opening of the big league baseball season, Washington versus the New York Yankees, with Vice President Wallace raising the American flag and President Roosevelt throwing out the first ball, as presidents have done since McKinley's first term. The president, the vice president, many of the cabinet, most of Congress will attend the game. There will be little legislation on Capitol Hill today. And Washington youngsters rally to the White House, where they roll gaily colored eggs down the little hills on the White House knolls. And that's been a custom in Washington since Grant's day. And you know, just let down our back hair, if the diplomats around here would really tell what they think about that Easter Sunday non-aggression treaty between Russia and Japan, they would say that it looked like a pair of sharp workers dealing each other cards from a stacked deck. But they don't dare to talk like that right out loud. There are half a dozen views of this agreement all around the world, but to us, plain-spoken, blue-jean boys from the hills, it is just one more arrangement like that of the preacher and the bear, whereby the preacher prayed long and loud to the effect that if you can't help me, for goodness sake, don't help that bear. But American officials here think that Russia has been outwitted, as if in dealing the cards, Russia was advised by some kibitzer from Berlin to deal a king off the bottom of the deck while the other fella put an ace up his sleeve. The Japanese say it's a smash deal for world peace. Washington still believes behind the doors that the Japanese idea of world peace is a free hand to roam at will in the South Pacific. That is world peace if there's nothing to start a war to stop further aggression. Inside the State Department, there is the general belief that much of the Russian diplomacy is based on Joe Stalin's personal fear of getting himself involved in some sort of a war somewhere, sometime, and then suffering the expected revolt in Russia. When the Russians get sore at a war, they always head for the man in the palace and knock him off. Once it was the Tsar. Today it is Joe Stalin. He's the same man in the same Kremlin as far as the Russians are concerned. Russian diplomacy is therefore what the statesmen politely call a balanced policy. It seems to adopt the view that the customer is always right. Then there are those who believe firmly that Russia is asking peace by the ton to remain at peace until everybody else is exhausted and then rush out and clean up. The long brewing controversy over convoys may break wide open in the Senate this week. There have been two developments during this congressional recess that have sharpened interest in the convoy question. The first one, as you may remember, was President Roosevelt's act in throwing open the Red Sea to American shipping. The second is this agreement I've been talking to you about. Opponents of naval escorts say this pact, Russia-Jap pact, will free the Japanese for further southward moves in the Pacific. And this, say the critics of this convoy idea and the critics of the administration's foreign policy, is a reason enough for not diverting any United States naval vessels to convoy duty. And Earl Godwin says goodbye. That's the news from Washington at this time.
And that's the news at home and abroad. This morning, Theodore Knaut reported from Berlin, John McVane from London, and Earl Godwin from Washington. This news roundup is heard at this time each weekday morning. Throughout the day, this station keeps you abreast of the news and invites you to stay tuned in. This is the National Broadcasting Company.